Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Bite-Sized Blessings. This week, I get to interview Raja Sahota, and his story is an interesting one. After graduating from high school in India, he worked a variety of jobs until truly finding the one that made his heart happy, and that was to go into these remote villages in India and kind of become a mentor, a teacher, and a leader for both the kids and the adults in the area. This work is what defines him and still what calls him. And so even though he's in Sonoma now in California, he has all the intentions in the world of going back to India and resuming this incredible and important work. This episode does come with a trigger warning. Raja talks about when he was a kid, they were at a vacation spot and he ran away from his family, went down a path into the woods and found himself in front of a decaying mansion, one that had been abandoned there in the woods. And unbeknownst to Raja, he picked something up in that mansion. And it's a really spooky story. So for those of you who are sensitive or nervous about hearing this kind of story, please take care of yourself. It does end up all right in the end, but the story is a little bit of an alarming one. And after saying all that, it's time for the episode. So episode 112 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
So I remember as a kid, this before it happened, we were in a place called Gandhinagar. So there's this little river we play around and there's watermelons growing there. It's awesome. So we would go there summer and I remember this little path going off and I run off into that path to explore and there's a mansion. A mansion which has got these abandoned completely. It has barbed wire around it, not to go there. And it has vultures sitting on it. I still remember that. Like haunted vultures. And I went and explored it. I've lost all memory after that. I don't have a memory of how I came out, what happened.
How would you introduce yourself to a group of people?
Oh, wow. Today, I would say I'm one of the most confused human beings on earth. Everything around me has changed. I'm kind of a dinosaur. I grew up with that being a Sikh man, and everything that you think wrong today is what we were taught as right. Fighting, beating, oppressing, taking advantage of men, women, take what you can. If you want something, just take it. It's your right. So that doesn't work anymore. So yeah, I would say today, I would say what I stuck to my own over the years is being compassionate, being really bothered about what happens around me. I am very optimistic, honestly. And that's a big failing for me because I always believe something's going to work. Even though we are driving off a cliff, it's like, yeah, we got time. I love to actually. That's what I live for, is fighting for causes which are going to lose. And I love that. I might have a demon living inside me, and that's a different story we'll go over. But it's because of that, I think I can survive these years. The demon takes over, and we somehow come out the other side alive. That's about it.
Have you read Philip Pullman's trilogy?
No.
Oh my God, it's so beautiful. He's a famous scientist who wrote this glorious series of books that kind of changed my life, along with Lord of the Rings, of course, and other books. But in the world that he creates, you know, children up until they reach adolescence have a daemon. D-A-E-M-O-N, who exist outside of them that take the shape of an animal. And it's kind of a metaphor for your interior soul, your conscience, that voice that is always talking to you.
It's supposed to give good counsel. I think sometimes it doesn't give good counsel. But once you reach adolescence and you mature, it goes inside your body and becomes a part of you. And I always thought that image was so amazing, that when you're a child, you know, you have this whimsical kind of sweet yet cunning and wily creature living outside of you that can change shape, by the way. Can be a rabbit, can be a fox 1 minute, kangaroo the next, depending on how you're feeling. Maybe that's what's living inside of you instead of what people classically think of as a demon.
I don't know, man. Yeah, but I was 7 or 8, I think. I literally got possessed for years, for 2 years, 3 years. I don't know if it went away. I remember talking, I've been estranged with my sister for many years, and I went and met her this year in her house, and we kind of patched up again. And I took Layla with me. She met her cousins. And she told me, she recalled not sleeping all night because my mother would guard the door. Yeah, and I would be just screaming because it was possessing me. It was telling me, it was trying to not make me breathe, and it was a very crazy time. So I think it's still there.
Okay, that sounds like a really intense conversation.
Yeah. I don't know how I've reached this age, honestly, with the things that have happened to me. I am surprised. And hence I started, that's why I have my child later on in life. I thought I would be dead by then. But I kind of did not die. So I'm okay.
Curious. I mean, you kind of alluded to it before this, but it sounds like you grew up in a religious household. What did that look like for your family?
Okay, this is where it gets complicated. My mother is Italian descent, and she's Roman Catholic. My father's complete family is Sikh, but they're not religious, but spiritual kind of thing. My grandmother was very religious. So there we go. My father, grandfather kind of rejected it. He was a very gentlemanly, nice person. One of the kindest human beings I've ever met, and the last kindest human being in my family I've ever met. So he wore a suit, and he was in the army. From scratch, he became an officer. He was self-taught. He read beautiful books. I still have his signed books over here lying with me. They're from 1950s, 40s. They're still original books lying here. He was an amazing guy. But my grandmother was the one that taught whatever I learned from religion. I like Sikhism a lot. It's very simple. It talks about embracing where you are and adopting that and just living with people and protecting people. I don't like the rest of it. Don't like the what we've been doing. So in the 80s, terrorism was huge in India and Punjab. We were fighting, sponsored by Pakistan, the typical story, which was getting arms from the CIA, which was trying to disrupt India. We were a blah, blah story. That time it was, nobody knew what was happening. So we've never been same since, you know, but I read the book because my father insisted I learn to read the holy book. So I know what it says. I do believe a lot in Sufism. So I'll listen to only Sufi songs so that it's more about people talking about, you know, the one big energy which we are all part of, and we are always away from it until we die. I don't believe in... I believe them. Okay, all these stories of gods and stuff, it's good. It's good lessons. And it's deeper lessons where humanizing certain aspects of... But God having feelings, I don't believe in that. If he does or she does or it does, it's got some cruel sense of humor. You know? So I don't believe that very much. I like the teachings. They're good. Of all religions. And I'm so interesting to see that there's this one teaching we all have common. And I don't think anybody teaches it. Is love everyone. Peace is best. Respect others. I don't think they teach that. It's like, where the F were you guys when they were teaching that stuff?
I think they teach it or they say it, but they just don't live it. Or they I don't. Think
by the way. By the way, you can also love people.
It's very interesting what you said about Sikhism initially, because to me, that's some of what you said is such a scarcity mindset. There's a real scarcity mindset in there, it sounds like, where you can just take because you feel like you don't already have. Is that, do you think that's true?
Greed. It's our generation of being landlords. It's the same as being these land barons in America, you know? Just take it all. And don't get, so they believe, like the gangsters in movies believe, is if you let even a small thing slide, somebody will take bigger slice. So destroy it now and be cruel about it, you know? Teach a lesson. And see how well that has served us.
Does it have a mystical element at all? I know Sufism is quite mystical.
Yes, it is mystical Sufism, but is Sikhism? Yes, we do. Because at the time, the way it was made was from the first guru. He was just a philosopher and amazing dude. And it was so oppressive. Hinduism is so oppressive. And we were being invaded by the Muslims who wanted to convert. So these two giant, like today in America, right? America, Muslims and Islam and Christianity. Oppressive. Both are so harsh. And then the set of people who are crunched in between are always the middle class, working class. And they're just banded together to just sit alone, not to be bothered by anyone, and just talk about love and living together and sharing food and actually being a little community where they're clean living, higher thinking, that kind of stuff. You know, that's where it started. So they took teachings off those days. Song and story were told from village to village by these traveling Sufi saints, they were called. They're very famous. They came all the way from Persia over the mountains. So by the time they reached Punjab, just imagine the distance and the amount of stories they traveled with. And the song, and they would bring it and tell us. And so everybody was phenomenal, especially Salim Chisti and Nizamuddin. They are still, they lived and died, finally, their lives in Delhi. So they came all this way across so many nations and brought their teachings and their song. And they practiced when they were at the top, they were in Delhi or in Punjab. So this community, which was fledgling, must have been so influenced by that amazing mysticism of free. Bindas is like without a master. Like, how is this person even alive without a master, you know? And those days, in the 400-500 years ago even, it was a phenomena.
That's really interesting. I like that word for without a master. What is it?
Bindas.
Bindas. Wow, that's really beautiful. That's really amazing.
Godas means God or master, and bin is without. So it's
okay.
Without master.
Okay. Oh, that's so fascinating. It is beautiful. It's so beautiful. So it sounds like you grew up over there.
Yes.
Overseas.
Yeah.
And then what was the, why did your parents move or leave? Or was it was you that decided to leave, I think.
From to the US?
Yeah.
Oh, I just came here 4 or 5 years ago. I did not leave. So my father was in the Air Force, and my father was not, he was a very, very good Air Force officer. That means we never saw him. And he also dumped us in our little hometown, Jalandhar. And my mom, who was, just imagine the scenario of this traditional Punjabi family. My mom being Italian, who doesn't even know Hindi, young, beautiful, dumped in Punjab while he's gone off. How she, that's a different story. But anywho, so we grew up there without a dad. I used to call him uncle when I see him. So I'm because I didn't know who he was. Yeah, sometimes, and he would come and enforce laws of his sometimes with his belt. And that's about it. Yeah, that's what we saw. My family was also being pretty destroyed amongst infighting in the village. And so I came towards when everybody was dying. Then we lost all our lands. Then I tried to go to Delhi and start a career. I had not had any education apart from high school. Then I went to Delhi. I lied my way, saying I did an MBA into Nestle. I got a job, which was horrible, as a marketing executive, which is the worst thing I've ever done. So I left that. I actually got an altercation with my boss in a what do you call them, those management meetings, and I ended up pulling his tie and slapping him. That got me fired. And then I got a small job with a property developer. And then I got into a fight with one of the guys who was stealing money. But he turned out to be the boss's brother, so I got fired. And then I met this dude who was running around India. I was dating this girl in Delhi. Her mother was working with him. It was called Cross Culture Solutions. Now it's a huge company. Now it's gone again. But it was just starting. The founder was a young dude from a state, from Peace Corps. And he was starting a new company. And I joined them as their, just to look after people. So that's the first time I saw international volunteers. That was in Delhi. Yes, we did there. I think I worked there 10, 11 years. Then I moved to Dharamshala with the same company. That's where I met my kids in the village. So I adopted literally all of them. The whole village was mine. And then I lived there for good long years. And then I met Elise and Lelu. And now I'm here. That's my journey.
Wow, it really is. It truly is a journey. Oh my goodness. That's so interesting. I'm so curious. When you moved to this village and you met all these kids, were they had their parents passed away, or did you just become kind of an uncle to everybody, or a brother? Okay.
So what happened is we moved there. So because my company, we were opening a new, we wanted a new, summer kind of thing for the mountains. And then I went over to Dharamshala. Somebody gave us a lead. I was told to go there and start the program from scratch. So I rented this house, got my team together, set it up. And the first program they sent me was with 50 volunteers with one house. Okay, anywho. So I had them all together and a bunch of young men and women who I was supposed to look after. And then this village, where we used to be, there's with these kids used to hang out smoking BDs and just, how kids are super young, 12, 13, and being so funny all the time. And I used to pass them every day. They used to say thanks to me and try to get a rise out of me. Till one day I stopped and I told them to basically shape up and to report. I just told them, just report to me tomorrow evening in my office at 5 o'clock. They had no idea who I was. They didn't need to. And they landed up at my office at 5 o'clock. And I told them, what do they do? And they're like, this is what we do. And this is how we got talking, how disappointing their life was. They're very poor, but very, very proud. I said, okay, let's just do one thing. You come here every week. And they used to stare at all these beautiful girls from America, looking at. I said, you know what? You can actually work with them. So I told them, how about we start a class here after their work, where you learn English and conversation. And so that's what they started. And then I started slowly organizing them. The needs got better and bigger. And then we started, few of them were extremely poor and in debt, high risk of being exploited. Then my salary, I started dividing between those families to help them out and pay off the debt and put them through school, organize them into a youth group. Then I used to take them 5 o'clock in the morning for workouts. And they hated me so much. We used to go for a run. We used to go into the. I bought a few equipment in a little room we have rented, and we go work out every day. The pull ups and push ups and weight training. The skinny little farts, and the girls would just laugh at the boys. That was pretty awesome. They had crushes on each other. You know, it's all taboo stuff, right? In India. And so I used to let them hang out every day at my under my supervision, so the parents didn't freak out. The parents hated me. There used to be parents who used to come drunk, men with friends, to beat me up at night almost every day. I'm going to cut off your head. I'm going to beat you. And I was like, you know what? This is what's going to happen. You are going to go home, get sober, and then come and beat me as much as you want. And he's like, tomorrow, you know, so yeah, tomorrow you will beat me up. Yes. But you know, over the days, we started working on parents, especially men who were drunks, alcoholics. We got motivated them to leave their drinking and start their work again. I opened 2 mechanic shops for them. So over the years, we did a lot of good work there. We got the whole village certified as first aid responders. So that they reduce, because the amount of deaths happen because people have to move a patient up. So that kind of reduced a lot of deaths. We used to do things like that. We used to clean the garbage every week for, it was so dirty. So me and my boys would clean garbage. They thought I was a garbage man for the longest time. The government came trying to put me in jail for interfere. I said, what am I stealing? They're like, you're taking people's garbage. Is it interfering with your wealth or not? And they're like, no, you're making us look bad. I was like, yeah, that's the point. That's the whole point. And I'm glad you're feeling bad. Oh, those were some interesting days.
Love for you to describe, you know, how you got into these motorcycle tours. How did that happen?
Okay. I'm in Dharamshala. One of the companies I started was with hiking and trekking and stuff like that. So there's one motorcycle in India called the Royal Enfield. It's called the Bullet, right? That's the old school name for it. It's a 350cc small motorcycle. Everybody loves it. It's a sign of like macho-ness, and every foreigner that comes in wants to ride a Bullet and go across the mountain because you don't need a license there. So everybody thinks they can just, yeah, you just have to be American and have a license. They don't give a shit about motorcycle licenses. And plus 100 rupees can get you out of that. And so that's a big business. I was riding when I was in Dharamshala, and I didn't like mountains and cars. They don't match. They are just too bulky to take around. So I said, okay, I'm going to ride. We have to ride a lot since, you know, Indians ride two-wheelers everywhere. So I decided to go for the Bullet. And I bought a beat-up old Bullet to just see if I like it. And I really liked it. We went everywhere on it. That was my mode of transport. Then I started meeting these travelers and these horror stories of theirs, of how they get ripped off, how they get, you know, these travel tours, all of the travel tours are like that. 80% people get ripped off. Women get exploited. It's a standard thing. And so I was like, damn, this is bad. I said, we should start one company just to show how it's done. And that's when it started. So my plans, as you will notice, are very grand. They might not be real. They might not be achievable. And they are definitely not... you can't put them on paper. So they are very grand. And that grandness was me being the beacon of showing how we can clean up this mess. And we had fun. We had a lot of fun. We had people coming in just asking us, please take us on tours. And I was like, I never asked enough money for them. I should have. Damn, now that I think about it.
You know, of course, I also have watched movies over the years that feature the Himalayas, and they show the mountains, but you don't really understand. Until you're there,
man. It's just, they're so grand. They're just so big.
It's like the perfect place for, I don't know, what a Yeti to live, I think. Someone who doesn't mind the cold.
I don't know. It's got some connection to somewhere. It's somewhere. I think the parts of Himalayas still have some energy centers there, which are connected to another world altogether. They're still there.
Of course, I do. I do too. Absolutely. I've always been amazed by the stories of those holy men who can go out with, you know, just a cloth over their body and sit in the snow with like no shoes on, no hat, no coat, nothing. They're in the snow and they are fine for hours because they're doing something to their body. They're using this breath, I understand, to stay warm, to keep themselves warm, which we would look at, you know, and from a Western perspective and say, that's a miracle. But no, it is a miracle, but they've also learned how to channel energy in their bodies and to use the breath to keep themselves alive and to keep themselves warm.
Yeah. If they have a monastery in Zanskar, which they're passing out, is that the acolytes have to go out and stay the night in the snow with just underwear on, and then they have to melt the snow around them. And if they pass their meditation, then I would freeze my nuts off, but it's so cold. It's so cold. It's brilliantly cold.
I need to start meditating more often, I think.
I tried, you know, my mind is a rabid monkey. It is a rabid monkey on steroids. I'm not even kidding. It wants to bust out of that prison. So I have two big stories amongst the little stories. One is of my possession when I was 8 years old, and I don't think it got fixed. I still remember having this person sitting on my chest and squeezing the life out of me every night. It would start at night, and it would finish as soon as the light came up. And I remember this happening for almost a year. Finally, they tried to purify the house a couple of times by many different methods. That thing was super powerful. So I remember as a kid, it's before it happened, we were in a place called Gandhinagar. So there's this little river we play around, and there's watermelons growing there. It's awesome. So we would go there summer, and I remember this little path going off, and I run off into that path to explore, and there's a mansion. A mansion which has got these abandoned completely. It has barbed wire around it, not to go there, and it has vultures sitting on it. I still remember that. Like haunted vultures. And I went and explored it. I've lost all memory after that. I don't have a memory of how I came out, what happened. And after that, this thing happened. And this incident kept happening till I remember faintly my mother found this guy in the middle of nowhere. He's under this huge banyan tree where they use it as to root for the exorcism as such. And they have a bunch of people there. And then he did something to me in which it calmed it down. It kind of, but I don't know if it's gone. Because I remember going back to Jalandhar and living there. And then I remember getting up every night for a period of time outside the house. I don't know how I got out there. I was sweating, I remember. And I would just go into the bathroom and pour water on myself to just cool myself. So that's one story. And I don't know how it affected my life.
I was going to ask you, you know, when you were a kid and you saw this mansion, I assume you crept through the barbed wire to get to it, but you weren't scared of it, even though it looked strange?
I was being an idiot, like most kids are, like, oh, I'm not scared. To my sister, who was like, ah, no, do this, do that. Like, yeah, I'm doing it anyway, because I'll get to see something awesome. And I did. And I've got a nice little friend that lives with me, probably.
I mean, I would imagine as a child, this whole experience was terrifying.
Yes, no doubt about it. I remember all that screaming and stuff.
And your family must have just been beside themselves.
Yeah, my mom was really trying. So she's Christian, so she would get her rosary out and pray all night. And that's how it kind of stayed away. But then she had these local exorcism people come in, and with the Hindu way and the blah, 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 blah. I don't know what they did. They were roaming around with lots of smoke everywhere and muttering all sorts of stuff and making me very uncomfortable all the time.
I mean, it sounds like you had to actually travel to go find this kind of, yeah, a medicine man. Or yes,
one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, they excel in the black arts. And they kind of keep, they're between the light and dark, right? And so they know where to send what happens.
Wow. It's rare to find those people, which is probably why you had to travel so far. And that kind of work is not easy nor fun because, you know, I've interviewed many people on my podcast and certainly we've talked about, you know, medicine work and healing work. And, you know, when you engage with whatever you're engaging with that's inside the other person's body, whether it's a story or a little gremlin or whatever, trying to get rid of it, a lot of times they say that that thing goes into themselves. And so then they afterwards have to, for several hours,
get rid of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, somehow it seems that you've made a sort of maybe uneasy peace with it. Would you say that's true?
I think so. And I think it kept me alive all these years through all that stuff that I've been through. I'm the most scaredy cat of this world. But when I'm in those situations, I come out always on top. I can't tell you, I have had a crash at 110 miles an hour on a friggin' highway. I crashed, I bounced off the asphalt. I haven't broken a bone in my body in my life. I have fallen out of planes. I have been shot at. I have been trampled, beaten, raped, everything in my life, but not broken a single thing. I don't know.
So it's like this really powerful and semi-benevolent entity. It sounds like it's protecting you now.
The second story actually ties in with this because it was in 1990, maybe I was a little younger. Just after my stint in the army, I got my job and I'm in Delhi. My father is a full-on drunk. He's a general in the Air Force, really high position, but he's sloshed all day in his uniform. I'm picking up on streets, I'm fighting for him and getting back home. And this fool, one day I get sick because I've gone to work. I didn't know I'd eaten something outside. So apparently, I found later, I'd gotten typhoid. So the fever was high up, 105, 106. I didn't know that. I come home, I'm dying, and my father's drunk. And he's like, he was leaving for my hometown. And he said, you better be ready tomorrow to go. He didn't give a shit. He left. That's when I got typhoid. So 3 days I was passed out in a house without food or water. And I somehow dragged myself to a doctor who is a friggin' quack. And he says, because my eyes were bloodshot, he said, oh, you got the eye flu. And he starts giving me drops for my eyes. So another 2 days I'm dying there. I have just a sip of water maybe I'm like just lost my weight and everything. So this is Delhi, one side. This is about 10 kilometers away from maybe more. From the bus station. I know I'm going to, if I have to live, I have to somehow make it. So like a hobo, I'm walking across Delhi in my flip-flops, half open shirt, my soiled pants, like a beggar, right? I walk across somehow to the bus station, to the bus going to my hometown. I pass out there for a couple of hours and the guy wakes me up there, what are you doing? I said, this is my scene and this is my name. And he's like, shit, you're dying. He's a nice man. He puts me in the back of the bus free of charge and drops me off at Jalandhar. On the way, he gave me 2 packets of juice as well. That was so sweet. He was trying to be nice and he didn't know what the hell was happening. Anywho, I reach there. I get on a rickshaw, reach home, and I collapse in my house. And that's when I remember waking up after about 3 days. My mother said I was blue. And she was shaking me. I thought I was in the best beautiful place in the world. But I'm afraid of heights. So I had to make this one step, just one step. It was a little jump, and that's, it's so peaceful. I mean, the feeling was, I can't even describe it. And then my mom freaking woke me up. I was like, damn it. So I believe I did pass over for a couple of hours. And hence, the world looks pretty bland.
Yeah, I mean, once you have those experiences and you go to those places, it's like, how does this reality even compete? There's no competition. It's impossible. None. It's impossible.
You cannot feel that love anywhere else.
Very grateful this week, another individual has decided to support me on the podcast through my Patreon page. Lisa Strasser Lamour, thank you so much. For those of you who might consider donating either $3, $5, or $10 a month to keep this podcast going, please click on the link below the episode's show notes. There's all sorts of goodies under each level, and there will absolutely be fun things in the future that those who support me through Patreon will get. Did I forget to mention that Raja also takes people on motorcycle tours through the Himalayan mountains? What does he not do? This man does everything. I swear, it is so hard to kind of distill down into one episode just what makes a human being who they are, but I try in my own little way. I need to thank Raja for telling me his stories and for also sharing this really vulnerable and personal story from when he was a child. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode, Winnie the Moog, Henrit, Musical Files, Frank Schroeder, Alexander Nakarada, and Sasha End. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to books, music, changemakers, and art I think will lighten and brighten your day. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Raja. Find peace with your past. Find peace with what haunts you, no matter what it is. Do the work, maybe get some therapy, maybe talk to a friend. But find peace with those stories that you formerly used to define you. Find peace with them, and I guarantee, you'll be able to sleep better at night.